Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight we have a poetry reading presented by the Boston University Center for Interdisciplinary Teaching and Learning at the College of General Studies and the BU Center for the Humanities. Our featured speakers are poets George Calogeras and David Ferry. We begin with an introduction by poet Marcia Karp.
George Calogeras' Guide to Greece is recently published and is superb. It lives in a now and a then which becomes a now, as well as in times earlier, later, and in between. Its then is 2nd century AD Greece. There, a Roman tourist guide to sacred sites was written by a Greek named Pausanias. There is no mistaking Calogeras' poems for those of another. If a poet has a voice and is like our poet, who gives all of himself in his poems, that voice is not sound only. Pitch and tone, yes, as Jeffrey Hill said many times here at BU, but not sound only. Voice is also the poet's methods. Here from on Sir James Frazier's note to the catalog of old trees in Pausanias. For the fragrance of lemons that runs the Aegean golden, consult the odes of Calvos. For the flicker of light that fissures the honeyed fig, see the orchards of Sion. Anachronism, Jeffrey Hill is the author of The Orchards of Sion, is one of George's methods in this volume and in others, and is never dated. Voice's judgment. Pindar's 14th Olympian ode has a weight in George's translation, not in those of others, and, to be unwisely bold, not in Pindar's either. For George has withheld until the final word who it is who will care most about young Esopicus, whose hair the breeze will never turn silver. The effect is that what is now most devastating is not the generalized heroic death, but it is hearing, just in the poem's last breath, who has received the, for them, too much particular deadly news. George's voice includes his choices to be silent and his characteristic close noticings. In Emma, he is sent in his sick mother's stead to his Armenian next-door neighbor for mint from her garden. He carries diplies, honeyed phyllo pastry made by his mother. This might have been a place to write about the great classical theme of reciprocity, but he doesn't need to because he lets us understand it's just how things are done. The child in the poem is child enough to know without knowing that his neighbor has suffered. Listen for what is noticed by the boy and the poet. Listen for history and myth, for the poet's past, and for a much older one. Even though I knew nothing at all about Virgil and those sweets he says the Sibyl used as treats to silence the triple mouths of Cerberus, I knew Emma heard barking from the gates of hell. Maybe it's only because she'd never seen me up close, or maybe the morning mist was coming off the ocean, back when the whole Atlantic was down the street. But something seemed to lift where Emma knelt and made her eyes water as I stepped through the fog, though it wasn't me she saw that day, but a boy who was just my age in the garden, holding out the honeycombs. In the poem Stephana, he's 10, visiting a friend whose mother weaves wedding crowns, Stephana. He has a forbidden moment alone looking into her workshop and sees as yet unadorned wire hoops on her table. He easily pictures how flowers will be woven onto them and the beauty and intimacy the crowns will bring to a marriage. He thinks of his parents' own crowns. When he looks again into the workshop, he sees then that the wire is the same as the clothes hangers in his parents' closets. This moment of change is the very stuff of voice, complex truth given in a way, given in any way a poet finds to do it. Finally, something a bit unusual, so I've kept it for last. You can see it for yourselves if you read Guide to Greece's first poem, Basil, together with Robert Hayden's great poem of enduring pain, those winter Sundays. The poems share Sundays and fathers and familial and religious duty. The similarities make their differences immediately apparent, to the detriment of neither of the poems or poets. Here, and in all his work, no matter the subject, George Kalogeros, Kalos Kagathos, writes in a voice without turmoil, the kindest of eyes and deep observation. George Kalogeros.
Thanks so much, Marcia. That was exquisite. And I want to start off with the title poem, Guide to Greece. And as Marcia mentioned, Pausanias is one of the guides. Pausanias was a second century Common Era Hellenistic writer who walked pretty much the whole of mainland Greece. And he created a sort of tour guide for the Romans, for Roman tourists. And he was particularly interested in the sacred sites, and he wrote down everything that he saw. Many of those sites no longer exist except in what Pausanias wrote down. The other guides are my parents, who were immigrants, had a little grocery store. Guide to Greece. Endless genealogies, as densely entangled as a grove of olive trees. His grasp of their roots extending all the way back to Epaminondas, who sprang from the earth of Thebes before it was Thebes. Cities erected on sites of ruined cities, their marble temples and strange foundation myths. Baedeker to Vassai, Athens, Delphi. For Roman tourists of the Pax Romana. And if this means, Pausanias, that no one knows better than you, that everything that's happened has already happened before, and also because Sparta and Arcadia are places you call Archaea Elada, and that's a term I heard my parents use to tell us where they came from when they meant to say Old Greece. I keep on reading down all the lists of names, Pausanias, keep paging through each region and wondering if perhaps you might have seen them, my elderly parents, somewhere in your travels. Cricket song. Titi Vizi. Those twittering cries the blackbird makes when it descends to drink from a pure mountain spring in late Sepphoris. A word that seemed to draw on demotic roots so obscure I couldn't find it in any of my dictionaries. Nothing from Oxford's Modern and Byzantine Greek or Liddell and Scott. Then I looked it up in your eyes, incredulous as you turned from the kitchen sink to enlighten my ignorance with a terse couplet fresh from your girlhood, a song about what the crickets sing at the height of summer. The dripping faucet gleams like a source that goes back to those early poets who loved to sing so much they forgot to eat. So the gods turned the poets into creatures so tiny that now they feed on the dew. Titi Vizi. Odysseus seeing Laertes. There's a moment in Book 23 of the Odyssey where Odysseus has come back. No one recognizes him except his faithful dog and his nurse. But he sees his father pruning trees. Odysseus seeing Laertes. It's getting dark, and he's still in the yard. By now, she'll be stewing over the steamy Katsaroulis. She has to reheat. But glad that he's finally home. He's inspecting his favorite tree, the sour quince. All day, he's been hacking away at carcasses of frozen chickens, piled up on his chopping block like little hecatombs of smoking entrails. The sour quince has put forth pink and white petals, like the flakes of sawdust stuck to his blood-stained work boots. As when I was a boy, standing away from the shade, and he would turn and see me and call me over, singing from the trees that line from the swallow song, "Come here, little bird, come here, come here. Don't go." My name in Greek is Yorgos Kalogeropoulos, and it's exactly the same as Maria Callas's father's name. So my parents immediately assumed we were related. It's not an uncommon name in Greek, but they took that liberty. So I want to read this poem, Jackie O Dead. Jackie O Dead, and that's the London Times headline. My parents abhorred the great Jackie O for marrying Onassis. "That widow's a curse," my mother hissed. "Just wait and see. And she's not that pretty. Not like Athena," meaning the blonde Greek ex. "And next it's my father's laconic kvetch. His business went bad, the cancer spread, his only son, Alexandros, dead. My parents never called him filthy rich, but Ochaimenos, the pitiful wretch. And from the way they said it to us, you'd think Onassis was Oedipus. Big oil, the glut of conglomerates. To my Marxist uncle, Leonidas, it was all a Western conspiracy. No uncouth Greek could rule the sea. It all came back in that front page headline I saw one rainy day in London. The sandwich board draped in plastic. Jackie O dead. Her favorite poet, Kavafi. The streaks of rain pelting the sheet of cellophane that keeps the yacht scotch taped to the door of our Frigidaire pristine. That's Churchill slumped in a deck chair. He looks out across the sunlit Aegean straight into our sallow linoleum kitchen. My mother's shade, still adamant, was somehow related to Maria Callas, whose name was no different than ours until she changed it, that diva. I was a student here decades and decades and decades ago, and I studied with two late great classicists, Donald Kahn Ross and William Arrowsmith. And this poem is about that time. The word demokratia, of course, means democracy. And TV sets weren't always as pristine as they are now. for those of us who remember the fidgeting with antennae. Ancient Athens on PBS. Finally home for the weekend. But when I enter, silence. My mother hardly looks up from the TV, sitting in the kitchen, transfixed before our zenith. For once, the screen's pristine. No static, no snow, no fussing with the antenna, frantic to stop the picture's waterfall of unreeling frames. None of that at all. Just zoned out focus. Unfazed that the fizz of her ginger ale is flat, or that the teetering stack of Triscuits remains untouched in its pewter dish. Then an ad comes on. She wipes away tears. So beautiful. Oh, this show. They show the urns and the people with their pebbles. The people putting their pebbles into the urns, into one or the other one. That's how it started. Demokratia. You know? Katalavinis? I'm studying classics with William Arrowsmith and Donald S. Con Ross, Euripides and Sophocles. I sit and watch the show. Later that night, just after Peter Jennings, her dentures go into a glass of soda water, and they don't come out again until the news from another century keeps mouthing the D word so much I hardly know what it means anymore. Bandied about in the name of brutal aggression, just as it was in the time of Thucydides. But my mother's shade is oblivious to the ironic. She clacks her guileless gums in genuine awe. Demokratia, you know, Katalavenis. And as the crumbs of the crackers crystallize, like specimen cultures in a Petri dish, she's still in her dusting apron, glued to the set. I want to read a slightly longer poem. It's called Language and Darkness. And it's about a friend who has had Lou Gehrig's disease for over a decade, if you can believe that. It's a total paralysis, and he speaks now through blinking his eyes, and there's a code that goes with that blinking. Language and Darkness. As dark as it is outside tonight, as dark as the haunted wood inside, as black as those spaces between the stars, light shines on a thrush's breast, singing in its sleep from desert places. Reading Radnati's eclogue, the one he scrawled in the searchlight dark of a Nazi labor camp, though not so dark that we can't pick up the gleam of an earthworm's slime as the line goes squiggling blind. In sickness and in sin, George Herbert cried, believing in affliction's Easter wings, though it was poetry that furthered the flight of the book he asked dear brother Farah to burn. Lovely, enchanting language, sugarcane, honey of roses, whither wilt thou fly? From this broken flesh we fly, Radnati replies, but only if reverie's key still turns in its lock. Paralyzed almost a decade by ALS, unspeakable, yes, but my friend George Mazareas speaks to his wife and young daughter by blinking slowly, spelling the words they read aloud from his eyes. And if they lose track of the letters, arranged in rows on a numbered mental grid, mortification. The blinking stops, like taps from the walls of a cell. Their voices go mute as the tube attached to his throat. And now the Haitian nurse, Elijah, kneels beside the wheelchair. The winged word arrives in the blink of an eye, but not until Elijah speaks by the gleaming spokes of a chariot wheel. When she'd refused a second glass of wine, Cynthia's husband, bound to his chair, began intently blinking his eyes. "Don't worry, honey. I can drive." His jaw snapped shut, but his biting, rueful humor still champing at the bit. Call it the self in extremis, expressing itself. It's George's way of spelling out who he is by telling us his gallant, sick joke at the party. Tony Jute, composing his final essays, late at night, still wide awake to the words, unable to scratch an itch or change his position, he writes in his head, but not in the dark, he said, lying in that excruciating bed. Origins. Behind the words, there is a poem. Behind the poem, there is a voice. Behind the voice, there is a breath. Behind the breath, there must be silence. Behind the silence is where the voice that speaks the poem is coming from. Inside the thirst, there is a well. Inside the well, there is no light. Inside the dark, there is an echo. Inside the echo, there must be longing. Inside the longing is where the water no bucket can hold is coming from. I'm going to finish with three newer poems. And the first one is called Reciting Henry Vaughan in the MRI. I had a colleague who passed away from cancer of the esophagus, and he was terribly afraid of being enclosed in the full body scan of the MRI. And the way that he got through that was to recite Henry Vaughan's great poem, The Night. So I want to read this poem. Reciting Henry Vaughan and the MRI. He had no other way of getting through it. So, lying flat and prone to panic attack, cocooned as he was in that dark, cylindrical shaft, he sang The Night to himself, his favorite poem. God's silent, searching flight, his still, soft call, was music he felt in the marrow of his bones, sore as they were from the after effects of chemo. And as his stressed out body was being scanned by ultraviolet, cancer detecting rays, the vigilant meter kept trying its level best to steady him until he felt suffused by the visionary poem's illumination. There is in God, some say, a deep but dazzling darkness. And saying that, it leaves no doubt. Devotion's beautiful verse believes what it says about salvation. Alive as we are to the dead metaphysical poet's voice, as it speaks to us from out of the dark abyss he's singing about. Inside the MRI, the sick man recited the night, and truly, however deep in his throat the cancer was lodged, the song appeared to soothe his rife with raging cells, esophagus. Until the conveyor belt had carried him out of the concrete portal, out of the lyric poem's hermetic seal. And then, poor claustrophobic soul, he was back in the world of light, exposed to the total, fluorescent, unfiltered horror of his dim prognosis. And now, not even tender Henry Vaughan could help him get through the night. And the Via Negativa was just that. Thank you.
From his first book, On the Way to the Island, 1960, until now, David Ferry has never published a frivolous or slight poem. His work has always been mature, and he undergirds his work with his great knowledge of the work of others. So it was with amusement that I heard him answer a question about the unusual pattern of repetition in his Sestina, The Guest Ellen at the Supper for Street People. With a certain defiant diffidence, he said he was unaware there was a pattern to be followed. He'd made his own. And then there is his rhyming of half of the N-words, torment, event, and enchantment. The new Princeton Encyclopedia of Poetry and Poetics says, the function of rhyme, i.e. sound repetition, in the Sestina is superseded by a recurrent pattern of N-words, i.e. lexical repetition. Now listen. One has to keep thinking there was some source of torment, something that happened someplace else, unclean. One has to keep talking in a reasonable voice about things done, say, by a father's body, to or upon the body of Ellen, in enchantment helpless, still by the unforgotten event, enchanted, still in the old forgotten event, a prisoner of love, filthy Ellen in her torment, guest Ellen in the dining room in her body, hands beating the air in her enchantment, sitting alone, gabbling in her garbled voice, the narrative of the spirits of the unclean. So much for the experts, i.e. the Princeton Encyclopedia. A farewell, 30 years older than the Sestina, is defiance itself. Here's the third and last stanza of Final Instructions. Shrink then into your dark, be locked up in yourself, shadow of shadow, be in your nothing dark. Oh, be keep to yourself, be close, be moat, be wall all dark. Hush, hear hush, vanish, know nothing. How then will the daylight knock at the lid in vain? Oh, be keep to yourself, be close, be moat, be wall all dark. The triumph of this strangeness doesn't resolve itself, but stays new and brilliant. Keep to yourself might be good advice when leaving. Be close borrows to yourself from the first instruction and might give comfort. But David has written something else. Be keep to yourself. Build of yourself now a castle. Then hush, hear hush, vanish. David strews his poems with beauties that change what poems might do. Such silly rules infect public thinking about poetry. Try really hard not to use the same word twice in a poem, for instance. But one of David's characteristic ways is to stay with words and to eschew paraphrase when there isn't reason for it or it would do harm. Here's a puzzle from Resemblance. Shades of the dead come back from where they went to when they went away. And now a description from Little Vietnam Futurist Poem. Other people were there, wearing pajamas, streaming out of some hidey hole or other, into the way that was how I saw them. The trees of the kind that grew there established the place. We know that way the story of what it was. The heart of David Ferry's poetry is his not lying about what it is for him to be alive. But not only for him. He's as faithful in his translations as in his own poems to the heartbreaking bewilderment living entails. Here he carries over to us ancient grief. In Carthage, seeking ease in his suffering, Aeneas comes upon murals depicting the Trojan War. He says to faithful Achates, "Look there, there's Priam pictured on the wall. Even here they praise his worth and tell our story. These are the tears of things for what they were, and what has become of them, the story of the mortality of men strikes to the heart." How lucky for us all to be here right now, David.
Thank you so much. I don't know what to say except I don't know if I can live up to any of that. Thank you so much. It's a poem called Soul. What am I doing inside this old man's body? I feel like I'm the insides of a lobster. All thought and all digestion and pornographic inquiry and getting about and bewilderment and fear, avoidance of trouble, belief in what God knows, vague memories of friends and what they said last night, and seeing outside of myself, from here, inside myself, my wavering claws, inconsequential, wavering, and my feeble, preternatural trembling with their amazing, troubling sensitivity to threat. And I'm aware of and embarrassed by my ways of getting around and my protective shell. Where is it that she I loved has gone as this cold seawater washes over my back? So I guess that's me. I also write it and want to read a short poem, Alphabet, ABC, You and Me, DEF, Dumb and Deaf, GHI, Blind of Eye, JKL, What's to Tell? MNO, All You Know. PQR, Who You Are. STU, Who Are You? VWX, Stones and Sticks. YZ, You and Me. And a poem called Ancestral Lines, which I want to read because someone here is quoted in it. But I want to read it for other reasons and attitude about poetry and what it can't do in teaching us ancestral lines. It's as when following the other's lines, which are the tracks of somebody gone before, leaving me mischievous clues, telling me who they were and who it was they weren't, and who it is I am because of them, or just for the moment, reading them, I am, although the next moment I'm back in myself and lost. My father, at the piano, said to me, "Listen to this." He called this piece Varum. And the nearest my father could come to saying what he made of that was lamely to say, "He didn't. Schumann didn't. My father didn't know why." "What's in a dog's heart?" I once said in a poem, and Christopher Ricks, when he read it, said to me, of course, he said to me, "Search me." Of course, he wasn't just funny. He was right. The two main things I want to read, one of them I've only read a few times before because they're a little longer than the poems that I usually write. One of them is I started to say translation, but it's not. I was in another work that I did with the Gilgamesh material. I called it a rendering rather than a translation, to dodge it for the fact that I don't know anything about reading Babylonian. I worked from the scholarly word-for-word texts and so on. But this other poem, which is the poem that the scholars call the Babylonian Job, is a very great poem, I think. Not as great, of course, as the Job poem, but remarkable in itself. Shubshi Meshre Shakan, hymn. I sing this hymn in praise of him who was the wisest of all, raging in darkness, or in the bright morning, calm, the wisest of all. The storm of his anger, it is that lays the land low. His breath in the quiet morning stirs but a leaf. The flood of his anger cannot be withstood. He is the Lord who pities and forgives. The sky will buckle under the weight of his hands. He holds the sick man gently in his hands. The thorns of his whip will cut into the flesh, and it bleeds. His poultice cools and eases the body's pain. It eases the pain, and the wounded body heals. He has but to frown, and the strength departs from a man. The strength departs from a man, and the man is weak. The Lady Fortune departs, seeking out others. He smiles, and the personal God comes back to the man. His strength comes back to the man and re-enters his body. The Lady Fortune returns from where she had gone to. narrative. Everywhere around me, there is confusion. Enlil and the other gods have given me up. The personal God has gone away from my house. The Lady Fortune has gone to somebody else. I see the omens everywhere I look. The king, the sun that shines on his happy people, the king is angry, and he does not hear me. When I go to the palace now, they look at me. One person blinks, and another looks away. What are these omens? How is it I should read them? When I lie down to dream, I have nightmares. In the street, I see the others looking at me. I see how people point their fingers at me. I hear them talking about me in the street. One says, I made him want to end his life. One says, I will take over his position. I'll be the one who goes and lives in his house. Six or seven talking in the street. Six or seven gathered in the street. Storm demons raging against me in the street. The year has turned, and wherever I look, the signs of my bad luck. I cannot find out anywhere what is right. I prayed to my personal God, and he doesn't answer. It is as if I did not pray to the gods. It is as if I did not properly say the name of the goddess before I eat my meal. It is as if I didn't teach my household how to honor the gods. It is as if I taught my household people how to neglect the holy days and festivals of the year. I kept the rules. To worship was my joy. The music of the procession delighted me. Before I ate, I spoke the name of my God. I taught my people how to honor the gods and to honor the king, as if he were a god. I taught my people how to respect the palace. I wish I knew these things would please the gods. I wish I knew the meanings of these things. Who knows the will of the gods in heaven? Who knows? Maybe the gods despise what men think right. Maybe what men think would delight the gods. Who knows the ways of the gods of the underworld? What man has ever learned the ways of the gods? Today, he is dead, who was living yesterday. From gladness to sorrow is but the blink of an eye. He sings in joy this moment, who wails the next. Around me, everywhere, there is confusion. Everything is strange. A storm wind drives me along. Sickness has come upon me. An evil wind has blown in from the horizon. As new little plants come up through the ground in spring, when their time has come, the weakness comes up through the ground. The cough comes up. It comes up horribly laughing out of the abyss. The headache comes up from the underworld. The bone ache comes from the surface of the waters. The Lamashtu demon comes down from the mountain. All of the demons gather themselves upon me. The phlegm fills up my throat, and my throat chokes. Whatever I eat is vile. Beer, solace of men, is vile in my mouth. Grain is vile in my mouth. All night the demons torment me. What are they saying? I cannot hear what it is they are saying. Where is my dignity gone and my good looks? The exorcist has nothing to say. The diviner has nothing to say. My personal God has not come to my rescue. The Lady Fortune has not. My chest was broad, my arms were strong, and now a boy could easily wrestle me to the ground. My looks are strange. The flesh is loose on my bones. I try to walk. My feet have forgotten how. My knees are fettered and bound like the buzu birds. At night, I lie in my shit like an ox or a sheep. My grave is open already and waiting. Already, all the funeral things have been prepared. He who gloats when he hears about it. She who gloats when she hears about it. The day is dark for all my family, for all my friends lamenting. The day is dark. His hand was heavy upon me. I could not bear the weight of his hand. I could not bear the fear of the storm wind screaming against me and blowing against me. I lay awake, or else I was asleep. There was a young man, beautiful, wearing new garments. I dreamed a priest was there holding in his hand a bough of tamarisk that purifies. There was a young woman came to me in my dream, beautiful, wearing new garments. She spoke to me, "Here is deliverance from your wretchedness." There was a young man came to me in my dream, bearded, wearing a headdress. He carried a tablet, and on the tablet written was a message. Marduk has sent me. I come to bring you luck. To Shibshat Meshre Shakan, I bring good luck. The storm of Marduk's anger was quieted down. A lion was eating me. Marduk muzzled the lion. Marduk took my hand and raised me up. He who had thrown me down, he raised me up. My knees, which were fettered and bound like a buzu bird's, my knees were free from their bonds, and I could walk. My throat, which was closed, was opened, and I sang. Hymn. The Babylonians saw what Marduk had done, and everything they said proclaimed his greatness. The storm of his anger it is that lays the land low. His breath in the quiet morning stirs but a leaf. The flood of his anger cannot be withstood. He is the Lord who pities and forgives. Who would have thought this man would see the sun? Who would have thought this man would walk again? Who would have thought we would see him on the street? What god but Marduk could bring back the dying? Who would have thought this man would see the sun? Who would have thought they would see him on the street? As far as the land extends and the sky above it, wherever the sun shines and the fire burns, wherever there were waters and where the winds blow, wherever the creatures are whom the goddess Aruru fashioned of clay, endowed with breath and life, the black-headed creatures, men who walk the earth, let there be praise for Marduk for what he has done. Thank you. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a poetry reading featuring George Calogeras and David Ferry. Tonight's reading was presented by the Boston University for Interdisciplinary Teaching and Learning in the College of General Studies and the BU Center for the Humanities. Introducing our speakers tonight was poet Marcia Karp. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Lee Shuna and Renee Marchando. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.